Everybody knows that when you toss a coin, you get a 50-50 chance that it'll land either heads up or tails up, right? And if you keep tossing that coin, probability predicts the pattern of those tosses. It's sooner or later, it's going to be 50-50. Well, what if I told you that LeBron James, Derek Jeter, and any player on a hot streak is no different than that coin? Those winning streaks are really just a part of a random process, though they themselves will tell you, no, I'm hot, I'm on a streak, this is not random at all. Sports, Yelp reviews, even the shuffle function on your iPod, they all come down to random sequences and how we perceive those patterns. In other words, you may think that you choose events to occur randomly, like when you choose rock, paper, and scissors, but it turns out that you are not really good at making random choices. And if you know that, you can take advantage of other people who think they are good at it. William Poundstone is the author of a new book, Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody. He joins us from NPR West Studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So there are tricks to this. People, even though they think they're acting randomly, they are not. They're a predictable pattern.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, this really goes back to the dawn of the computer age. How I got interested in this particular topic was that I heard these stories about a mind-reading machine that they had built at Bell Labs in the 1950s. And the way it worked, you played a simple guessing game with it. You basically chose heads or tails. And the computer would try to predict which one you were going to choose. If the computer guessed correctly, it won a point. If you fooled the computer, you won a point. And you'd play it several times in a row like that. And the computer would gradually see any sort of patterns you had. Well, this thing became a sensation at Bell Labs because, you know, at the time it was the center of the tech world. You had Nobel Prize-winning scientists coming to visit, and they'd all be pulled into this room where they had this mind-reading machine and challenged to play the machine. And none of them could beat the machine. Because it basically demonstrates that we really cannot act randomly, even when we try very hard.
Our number, 844-724-8255, talking with William Poundstone. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And so finding out that that people really cannot do things randomly, you give a lot of different strategies for recognizing when these things are happening. Since the title of your book is Rock, Break, Scissors, we put up a simple digital version of the game on our website. We asked people to play the game, and the results we got as of today was 35% rock, 35% paper, 30% scissors. How does that match up with the usual breakdown of the three?
That's almost exactly it on the nose. They've done studies of players and found that that's generally the thing. Scissors is the least popular choice for some reason. So just knowing that fact alone can give you an advantage when you're actually playing the game.
Mm-hmm. You say that most men throw out their fist first. The way to beat the system is to know that. If you're at a bar and you want to do something for drinks, you say, okay, let's play rock, paper, scissors, and you throw out. You'd be the first one to throw out.
Yeah, you'd throw out paper because your friend is going to play that rock. Right. And generally speaking, you know, when a person doesn't have time to think about it, to rationalize it, they tend to go for that rock.
So you start the game immediately without anybody doing it for you.
Yeah, definitely.
The final match of the World Cup is coming up this weekend. And you say that in penalty kicks, that soccer players are better at randomizing. What do you mean by that?
This is quite interesting because they've done studies of all sorts of sports with, you know, the professionals playing the game. And in many sorts of sports, there is a random element. Like in baseball, you're switching from one pitch to another. In the penalty kicks in soccer, the goalie has to decide which direction to favor, where he's going to jump so that he can get the ball. For some reason, they have found that in almost every sport, people are terribly bad at randomizing, but the one great exception is soccer penalty kicks. The only thing that they've found that where you can really exploit it comes to the fact that when a team is behind and when they really need that that penalty kick goal, the goalie tends to move to the right. So if you're, you know, kicking the ball, you should kick to the right as well, which will be his left, and most likely he will not be able to return it.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the strategy to watch for this weekend in penalty kicks. So you're saying then that in baseball, when it's the batter is, you know, locked up with a pitcher trying to figure out what pitch he's going to throw, that it's not random at all? Is he better at guessing, or is it really a random event?
Well, of course, each player has their own strengths, and they try to favor the particular pitches that they're best at and the ones that they think work best against a given player. But even when you take that all into account, they're really not very good at randomizing. When a player throws a fastball, they've shown that the chance that he's going to play another fastball on the next pitch is about 3% less. When really it should be the same if you were doing everything perfectly randomly, no matter how much you used it. So again, it just reflects the fact that our minds really are not built to make random choices.
Mm. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and talk lots more with William Poundstone, author of Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody. Our number, 844-724-8255. If there's somebody you want to outguess or outwit, give us a call. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Just stay in the boundaries, though. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday, talking with William Poundstone, author of Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody. And we were talking about sports when we left. If you're just joining us, let's continue in sports just a little bit longer. You know, everybody who's in sports talks about, hey, he's really hot. She's got a hot hand. Well, look at that. You know, in the 2013 NBA Finals, Danny Green of San Antonio makes 25 out of 38 three-pointers. Is there such a thing? Is that truly? Is there such a thing as being on a hot streak, a hot hand?
No, they did a classic study in the mid-1980s, Thomas Gilovich, Amos Tversky, and Robert Fallone, where they got statistics from the Philadelphia 76ers, looking at every single attempt to make a basket, how many succeeded, how many failed, and looked at the actual statistics of it to see whether it was random or whether there really were these predictive hot streaks. And they found no evidence at all that there were these real hot streaks. I mean, of course, there are, you know, sequences of successful baskets, but they're no longer or more common than you would expect by the normal operations of chance and that particular player's season record. I mean, obviously, the better players made more baskets.
Right.
But again, once you factored it in, it was basically random. This has become one of the most controversial of all papers in psychology, because so many fans out there, you know, they have this perception that there are these hot streaks and that a player who is on a hot streak is more likely to make the next basket. And of course, this is something that even influences the strategy in the game. I mean, the coaches believe in it. They tell their players to try to, you know, block the player who's got the hot hand, to make sure that to pass to a player on your team who's got the hot hand. But they've basically shown that this is a cognitive illusion. It's something we're all susceptible to, but it's really not there. And if you try to base your strategy on it, you're really not going to do very well with it.
Is it a statistical anomaly that happens normally, a bunching of numbers?
People just don't understand what real randomness is. If I were to toss a coin repeatedly, in about 100 tosses, you would probably find maybe 4 or 5 heads in a row. And people think, you know, that can't happen just by chance, but it really does. It's funny, in the book I talk about a famous mathematician, Theodore Hill, who in his classes did an exercise where he gave the homework where people were supposed to go home and toss a fair coin 200 times and record whether it was heads or tails. But they had the option of doing that or else just making up the data, not actually tossing the coin. The next meeting, everyone brought in their papers, and he would simply look at the papers, and he could tell who had the real random data and who had made up what they thought was random data. And one of the things he found is that there just weren't enough long streaks of the same heads or tails when people were making up what they thought was random data. So this shows that it is something very hardwired in our brains. We really don't understand this concept of randomness.
Is there any sport, an exception where hot hand might actually be real?
Yes, they have actually shown that. You see it in bowling.
Bowling.
Now, when you ask why, you have to consider that, first of all, it's an individual sport. If you could actually, the ball's the same, the pins are the same every time. So if you could actually put your brain and muscles in the same place, you could presumably roll a strike every time. But not only that, you've got a scoring system that incentivizes a sort of hot streak or hot hand, because if you make a strike, the next two frames get counted onto your score. If you make a spare, the next frame. So people really do have this incentive to discipline themselves and make another strike after the first one. And basically, it's the people who are able to do that who become the good players of bowling. So in that one sport, you do see a genuine hot hand.
Is there a hot hand bias that shows up outside of sports and in other things in the real world?
Yes, definitely. In fact, it was an interesting experience just writing this book, that once you hear about this and talk to people, you start seeing the hot hand in everything. A good example is the Manhattan bus schedule. You can be standing on a corner where there's supposed to be a bus every 8 minutes, but as we well know, it doesn't work out that way. You may wait 20 minutes and then three show up at once. Well, what happens is the traffic, almost makes it so that those buses arrive randomly. And we just don't realize that, if you have a random sequence, there are going to be long gaps of no buses and then all of a sudden several all at once. Another, maybe even the classic example nowadays, is the shuffle play feature on, a music player. Almost everyone complains, and you can go online and look at the complaints on consumer boards, that the shuffle play just isn't random. It will play the same artist three times in a row. It will keep playing the same kind of music. It will never play certain songs in your library. But if you look at the statistics, and I mean, Steve Jobs, swore up and down it was truly random. Really, it is being random, but to our brains, we just don't perceive it that way.
And let's talk about what I saw fascinating, an easy thing that we all take, the test, the multiple choice test, the four-question multiple choice test. You have a way of tilting the odds in your favor.
Yes, definitely, because, of course, the teachers who make up these tests are susceptible to the same misperception of randomness that we all are. When you make up a test, you're basically trying to put the answers in random order, obviously, so no one can guess. But that's easier said than done. And I looked at about 100 tests, both from schools, driver's tests, all sorts of tests, and found that you have the exact same pseudo-random patterns that you see in other contexts. So this really does give you a statistical edge. On a multiple-choice test, like if there's four options, you would expect that a given answer would be repeated twice in a row about one in four times. In other words, if the answer is B this time, you'd expect a one in four chance of it being B next time. But actually, it's a lot less than that, because people just don't want to repeat the same answer twice in a row. And in fact, you see a lot of tests where if you look at the answer key, it's like they're playing hopscotch. They just don't like to repeat. Well, when you think about it, if you're aware of that and you have to guess on a particular thing, I mean, that gives you a real edge. And there are a number of other things I found that were very useful. For instance, in true-false test, true answers are about 56% of all the items. And when you look at why that is, I think it's just because, it's such a drag inventing all these items for a test. And it's much easier to just remember a fact that can be your true answer as opposed to inventing a falsehood. And I think teachers just sort of follow the path of least resistance there. Now, what was interesting, the thing I found that was actually the most useful in guessing involved these none of the above or all of the above answers. You usually encounter these on multiple choice with either four or five options, and at the end there'll be, say, none of the above. Well, I found that these none of the above answers were right more than half the time, 52% of the time, when by all reason they should be right just about 20% of the time on a five-point test. And the reason for that, I'm pretty sure, is that you can't just drop these questions into, or these answers into the question. I mean, all the other options have to be written about it, around it. And, you know, that's kind of difficult. So for the most part, teachers don't make up enough wrong none of the above answers to really be strategic. So when you see one of those, unless you can totally rule it out based on your knowledge, that's really the one you should guess.
And as far as the multiple choice, other choices, what about the ones on the ends, the A answer or the D answer? Is there a bias there for staying away from the end or going toward the middle?
Well, actually, on five choice questions, usually the end, answer E, is the one that's most commonly correct. But on four choice questions, it tends to be B, the second one. Which is kind of interesting because I remember as a kid, I was always told to pick the middle choice, that was supposed to be most common. But it wasn't really borne out in my study.
844-724-8255 is our number. And we're talking about taking advantage of people not believing that they're random. They're not good at picking random things, or they think they are. What is the gambler's fallacy? So it's the opposite of the hot hand, you say.
Yes, in a very real sense. I believe it was in 1913 in Monte Carlo. At the roulette tables, black came up 26 times in a row. And after about 15 times in a row, everyone mobbed that table because they all wanted to bet on red. They figured if black has come up so often, then red must be overdue. And they ended up losing tons of money on this, and it was very profitable for the casino. This is known as the gambler's fallacy. Obviously, a roulette wheel does not have a memory. It is genuinely random, at least if it's working properly. Yet people don't really believe that. They believe that after so many blacks in a row, you're going to get a red, and that the chance of a red is more than 50%. And this, of course, is wrong. This is kind of the very opposite of the hot hand. And when you look at why we have this difference, it really comes down to the idea of a human being involved. We're susceptible to this gambler's fallacy when dealing with mechanical things, with gambling equipment like dice or cards. But when we see a human being and he makes like five baskets in a row, we don't say, oh, you know, he's overdue to lose. We say, wow, he must have some magical ability. He's on this hot streak. I'm going to bet on him to make the next basket. So that's really the difference there. So we're basically susceptible to two different kinds of fallacies.
If you deal, let's say, in a casino with someone who's dealing cards, let's say playing blackjack, for example, versus a machine that you're playing on, are the odds different by playing the machine, which is allowed to take a profit by the state in a certain percentage? Is that different because the machine knows what you have in your hand versus dealing, you know, with a blackjack that doesn't know what's in your hand?
Yeah, they have a lot of license to do what they want with the machines, and basically it's, you know, it's the consumer's decision whether you want to play that machine or play with a human dealer. And of course, you know, human dealers cheat too, so I would even hesitate to say that one's better than the other.
Human dealers cheat?
Yes.
Okay.
I actually wrote a book called Fortune's Formula about Ed Thorpe, who, of course, invented card counting in blackjack, right. And he knew quite a bit about that.
Wow. Our number, 844-724-8255, being educated by William Poundstone, author of Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody, on Science Friday from PRI, from Public Radio International. A few more minutes. Let's get a few more tips in. Let's talk about when you go online. And, you know, you're going to one of the Amazon or one of the places, and you're going and you're clicking on buying something. It goes into your shopping cart, but you don't buy it immediately. Can you gain some sort of advantage there?
Yes, definitely. This is known as the abandoned shopping cart gimmick. What you do, you put something in your shopping cart and you start to check out. You enter your name, your email address, your address, but then you go to the page where you're supposed to enter your credit card information, but you don't do it. You just navigate away and, you know, wait several days. What will usually happen is that you'll get an email from that company gently reminding you that you have not completed your purchase. And very often that email will contain some sort of freebie. It may say we'll give you free shipping if you complete the purchase, or we'll give you a discount on your next purchase. So if you do that, as a rule, you can get, you know, these free shipping and discounts. So it's a good thing to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. So if you go away, so it's best, it's sort of like playing a game with them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is really comes out of data analytics. They've just found that, you know, first of all, many, many online purchases are not completed. Mm-hmm. It may be that you're at work and the boss comes in, so you don't finish it. But for whatever reason, they found that it is very effective. If they send out these emails with some sort of freebie, most people mm-hmm. will then complete the purchase, and they'd rather get a new customer, even if they're losing a little money on this particular sale.
If you have to pay a bill to somebody, let's say, you know, your cable people or whatever, is there any advantage you can get in paying that bill?
Well, what I found, I was quite intrigued by this because I get these weird phone calls from the cable company, from the gym, from the phone company. Basically, someone just asking, we want to thank you for being a customer and ask if there's anything we can do. And I never knew what to say to that. But it turns out if you get that phone call, it's because their data has predicted that you're more likely than not to discontinue service. So they want to be proactive and, you know, try to induce you to continue the service. So what you should do in that situation is say, yeah, I'm not happy with the service. I think it's too expensive. I'm thinking of quitting it. The person on the other end is following a very careful script, and they will then offer you what's known as the primary offer. And again, this is usually some sort of discount. If you will renew now, we'll give you a 10% discount. But never take the first offer, because they almost always have a secondary offer, which sometimes is better, sometimes is just different, but you might as well hear both of them. So pick the one you like best and go with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. This is great. I noticed that when you ask to go to the disconnect people, suddenly the offer gets much, much better. When you tell them to disconnect the service, stuff comes out of the woodwork that they never had before. William Poundstone, author of the new book, Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody. It's going to upset whatever you thought about life and what you think about randomness and how people act. Thank you very much, William, for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you.